This is Radio Moscow. Good evening, everybody. We are transmitting on 11.63, 11.89, 15.16, 15.41, and 15.44 megacycles per second. At 7:30, four of these frequencies are dropped. One frequency is added, which means that we continue broadcasting until 7:50 Eastern Standard Time on 11.89 and 15.23 megacycles only. Here's what we offer this evening. First, the news, then a review of Monday's Pravda, and Ilya Ehrenberg's reply to Mr. David Lawrence. Then on the hour, you hear Moscow Newsreel. At 7:15, sidelights on Soviet life. At 7:30, the news and the commentary. We sign off at 8:10 with the Soviet anthem. This is Radio Moscow, and here's the news. First, the latest news flashes from the Foreign Minister's Conference. As we announced, there was further discussion this evening on the Austrian treaty draft. The French delegate Paris reported that the deputies had worked out agreed texts of the articles on war criminals, on the evacuation of German nationals from Austria, on the withdrawal of the Allied troops from Austria, and on Austrian property on the territory of United Nations. Articles on which no agreement was reached at the deputies' meeting, including those on frontiers, on the evacuation of displaced persons, on restitution, and certain points of some other articles. In a statement supplementary to Monsieur Paris' report, Andrei Wyszynski announced the formula proposed by the Soviet delegation on the question of the Austro-Yugoslav frontier. This formula runs, the Soviet delegation regards as well-founded the Yugoslav government's proposals on the reunion of Slovene Carinthia with Slovenia, which is part of Yugoslavia, and also on the Slovene frontier areas in Styria, and on granting a special status to the Burgenland Croats, which would assure their national rights, as set forth in the memorandum submitted by the Yugoslav delegation to the Conference of Foreign Ministers' Deputies in London on January 22, 1947. The Soviet delegation reports the above-mentioned proposals. The ministers approved the articles agreed upon by the deputies. With regard to the article on the evacuation of displaced persons from Austria, Vyacheslav Molotov stated that the Soviet delegation did not insist on specifying a definite evacuation term in the treaty, leaving that term to be fixed by the Allied Commission in Austria. The article on displaced persons, on which the principal disagreement has been ironed out, has now been turned over to the deputies for drafting. The article on restitution, which the ministers have coordinated in the main, has also been referred to the deputies. A plenary session of the Soviet Central Trade Union Council closed here in Moscow today. Two questions were considered at this session. The first was the conclusion of collective agreements between the managements of industrial, transport, and building units and the trade union factory committees. The second question was the holding of elections to the regional, Republican, and central committees of the trade unions. Among the speakers at the final meeting was Vasily Kuznetsov, chairman of the Central Council. An enthusiastic message of greetings was sent to Generalissimo Stalin. This year's rehabilitation and development plan for Belarus has just been approved by the government of that republic. The cultivated area in Belarus is this year to show an increase of over 1 million acres. Power station capacity is to increase by more than 57%, and the amount of power generated by nearly 63%. Large-scale housing construction will be carried out before the end of the year, and a lot of money is being put into the development of education and public health in Belarus. At the Great Dnieper Hydroelectric Station, the second turbine is now being installed. The three-chamber lock is being restored and will be ready for operation in a few weeks' time. This will make navigation possible again along the whole of the Dnieper, which measures upwards of 1,200 miles and is the third longest river in Europe. the Second Congress of Estonian Labor and Peasants has closed in Tallinn, the capital of Soviet Estonia. Addressing the Congress, Chairman Weimer of the Estonian Council of Ministers spoke of the land reform now completed in the Republic. Over 40,000 former farmhands and land-hungry peasants have been given allotments, over 1,150,000 acres in all. Those who are just setting up as farmers have also been given 20,000 farm buildings of various kinds. In the past 2 years, the government has granted the peasants loans totaling 160 million rubles. Government-owned machine and tractor stations and machine and horse hiring depots will be helping the Estonian peasants this year with the cultivation of 275,000 acres. We have some details today from Soviet Georgia about one of the five big irrigation systems now being constructed in this republic. The Upper Samgori project will make the Samgor and Vizi steppes areas of intensive agriculture. At present, the work has reached the stage of digging the two large reservoirs that the system is to have. These reservoirs will together hold upwards of 620 million cubic meters of water. The Moscow Children's Film Studios are working on a full-length feature film called The Young Guard, devoted to the underground youth organization of the same name in the town of Krasnodon, whose gallant underground fight against the Nazis made the names of its members known throughout this country. Gerasimov is the producer of the film. Another producer, Lukov, is making a picture about Alexander Matrosov, the Soviet fighting man who stopped the mouth of an enemy machine gun with his own body. Of the other films being shot in these studios, one deals with Soviet schoolchildren. The table of world weightlifting records will have to be revised following yesterday's feat of Alexei Zhizhin of Leningrad. Zhizhin raised 97 kilograms, 800 grams, with a left-hand jerk. That's half a kilogram better than the world lightweight record which Zhizhin established last year. A Belgrade dispatch gives the answers of Marshal Tito to some questions put by correspondent Sayers of the London News Chronicle. Marshal Tito pointed out that the question of establishing better relations between Yugoslavia and Britain was not something isolated from the general system of international problems. It is connected with the struggle for peace and the consolidation of peace. If, said Marshal Tito, we encounter utter lack of understanding and opposition on all matters of interest to Yugoslavia, the proper kind of relations cannot grow up. The Marshal stressed that 99% of the Yugoslav people supported the government's foreign policy and added that the Yugoslav government was anxious for the maximum number of Yugoslavs to come home from abroad. He went on to note that the Anglo-American military authorities encouraged elements hostile to the People's Republic of Yugoslavia. 90% of the Yugoslav emigrants would come home at once, he said, if it were not for the lying propaganda carried on among them. To Sayers' question about Slovene Carinthia, Tito replied that not only the population, but the very territory of this region was Yugoslav, and that Yugoslavia had strategic grounds, too, for insisting that Slovene Carinthia should be reunited with her. The Romanian parliament meets on Friday for the special session which will discuss ratification of the peace treaty. A Czechoslovak trade delegation is in Sofia to make a trade agreement with Bulgaria. The delegation of Soviet women now staying in Italy arrived yesterday in Milan. The food situation in the western zones of Germany is still deteriorating, and the ADN agency reports that in Hanover this week's daily ration will be only 770 calories. Spokesmen of the Bizonal administration, who have hitherto been making optimistic speeches, now say that it's not a case of food crisis, but of food disaster. Mr. Gomułka, Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for the Western Territories of the Polish Republic, speaking at a meeting in Szczecin at the end of Western Territories Week, said that the Polish people were carrying out and would continue to carry out the Union of Polish Territory, laying the foundations for a new social structure. The Western Territories, he said, are a necessary condition not only for bettering the life of the Polish people, but for the existence of the Polish state. Whoever aims at the Western Territories of Poland, said Gomułka, aims at the very heart of Poland. According to an Athens report, the past few days have seen increased partisan activity along the railways, bringing supplies to the government troops in southern Pindę. the partisans took possession of the railway junction of Liancocladi, and in another place, they blew up a bridge. The papers report big battles in the mountain district of Kisovas, where the government is using aircraft. Today, the National Court in Prague passed sentence on Beran and former members of his government. Beran, traitor to the Czechoslovak people, was sentenced to 20 years imprisonment. The Chinese paper Dagon Pao reports that yesterday over 80 Chinese correspondents from Peiping and Tianjin wanted to visit the new port at Tangu, but American Marines at the point of the bayonet compelled them to return to their train. In this connection, the Association of Peiping and Tianjin Correspondents has published a statement emphasizing that foreign interference in the movements of Chinese people on their own territory cannot be tolerated. It is worth recalling that a week ago, American Army police in Tianjin prevented correspondents from visiting the railway station. The Netherlands business paper Nationale Rotterdamse Courant has printed a series of articles by its correspondent on life in Moscow and Leningrad. "I went everywhere I wanted," the correspondent writes. "I was in the streets and in the underground and on trains, in the heart of the city and on the outskirts. I met workers and intellectuals and schoolchildren. The broad streets of Moscow with their endless stream of cars and pedestrians," the correspondent writes further, "give an indication of the vigorous work of the Soviet people." He also speaks of the Soviet people's desire for peace and friendship with all freedom-loving nations. Preliminary returns are available of Sunday's Landtag elections in the British occupation zone of Germany. The Social Democratic Party polled 3,100,000 votes, the Christian Democratic Union 2,700,000, and the Communist Party 900,000. A Hamburg broadcast notes that the hopes connected with the fusion of the British and American zones have not materialized. The fusion has not checked the further deterioration of the economic position and the depression of the standard of living. The government of the North Rhine-Westphalia state has protested against the plan to move 12,000 Yugoslavs from a British camp in Italy to towns in the British zone of Germany. It points out that the presence of displaced persons in Germany has had the most deplorable results, and urges that the displaced persons who are in North Rhine-Westphalia already should be sent home. The American command in Austria has announced that inmates of the Glasenbach camp for Nazi war criminals will be given leave of absence from the camp if they can show sufficient grounds. Six patriots were put to death in Spain on Thursday and Friday, Reuters reports from Madrid, quoting reliable sources. In Belgium, the supreme judge of the military tribunal has appealed against the acquittal of the heads of the Fabelta-Febron concern. The defendants, who collaborated actively with the Nazis, were originally sentenced to imprisonment, but a higher court repealed the sentence and acquitted them. It is against this wrongful acquittal that the supreme judge protests. Belgian newspapers report demonstrations by Flemish fascists who parade in Nazi uniform, bore fascist songs in the streets, and so on. In Antwerp, uniformed fascists held a rally by the grave of the executed traitor August Worms. French Ministry of Labor officials have gone to the French zone of Germany to make arrangements for recruiting displaced persons for coal mines in France. This is reported by the German ADN agency. And that ends this news bulletin, which came to you from the studios of Radio Moscow. Now, here's a review of Monday's Pravda. Top front page space goes to the congratulatory messages exchanged between Prime Minister Tyrankiewicz of Poland and Generalissimo Stalin, the chairman of the USSR Council of Ministers, on the second anniversary of the Soviet-Polish Treaty on Friendship, Mutual Aid, and Post-War Cooperation. In a commentary on this anniversary, Pravda says that the 2 years which have elapsed since the conclusion of the Soviet-Polish Treaty have fully proved its vitality and confirmed its historical and international importance. This treaty has been the foundation for the development and consolidation of Soviet-Polish friendship and the promotion of economic and cultural cooperation between the two countries. Also for their common struggle for peace and security, both in Europe and the world at large. Pravda points out that the world has had many occasions to see that the Soviet Union always upholds the legitimate demands of the powers which suffered most from Nazi aggression. Such support, says the paper, is especially important today when there are frequent attempts to exert pressure on those countries by playing on their post-war difficulties. Such attempts have been made with regard to Poland as well. Pravda also points to efforts of another kind. For instance, to cast doubts on Poland's western frontiers, although they were determined by the Crimean and Potsdam decisions. In all such cases, it says, the Polish people have had the support of the Soviet Union. Pravda declares in conclusion that on this second anniversary, the Soviet public feels certain that the Soviet-Polish treaty will continue to promote the consolidation and development of Soviet-Polish friendship and the strengthening of peace and security in Europe. Most of the rest of Pravda's front page is given over to a letter addressed to Joseph Stalin by the farming people of the Krasnoyarsk region in Siberia. On entering the countrywide output drive to mark the 30th anniversary of Soviet power, the farmers pledged to secure a bumper crop this year. One of the longer items in the Monday Pravda deals with the development of Soviet trade. The author underscores how important for improving material conditions and living standards is realization of the government decree about developing cooperative trade in foodstuffs and dry goods in the towns and workers' settlements, and increasing the output of foodstuffs and consumers' goods by cooperative establishments. Where are the Kuomintang reactionaries leading China? Is the title of the main foreign news discussion in today's Pravda. Marinin, the commentator, notes that the December 1945 decisions of the Moscow Conference of Soviet, American, and British foreign ministers have not been carried out. During the 16 months since that conference, the situation in China has become even more acute. The policy of the Kuomintang has brought the country to a most acute crisis. The civil war has never been so sharp or so widespread. Democratic elements are ignored more than ever before. There can be no doubt now, says the Pravda commentator, that the Kuomintang reactionaries who disrupted fulfillment of the Moscow Conference decisions were instigated and urged on in this by the policy of the United States in China. The commentator cites numerous facts to show that the main decisions of the Moscow Conference, stipulating non-intervention in China's domestic affairs and the withdrawal of all foreign armed forces from China, have not been carried out by the United States. With regard to the proposal made by Vyacheslav Molotov early in the present session of the Foreign Ministers' Council, to hear information on the fulfillment of the 1945 Moscow Conference decisions on the Chinese question, the Pravda commentator says that this proposal was widely acclaimed by Chinese Democrats. The reactionary Kuomintang camp, on the other hand, raised a hysterical hue and cry, claiming that any exchange of opinion on the fulfillment of the Moscow decision on the Chinese question violated China's national sovereignty. Significantly enough, the same arguments can be found in certain American newspapers. This united front of Chinese and American reactionaries is not at all an accident, Marinin declares. And it is just that which represents a serious menace to the national independence of China, her unity and democratization. You've been listening to a review of Monday's Pravda. It came to you from the studios of Radio Moscow. Early this month, Ilya Ehrenberg wrote a criticism of the American Russian language broadcast, The Voice of America. The criticism appeared in the Soviet newspaper Culture and Life under the heading A False Voice. In reply to this, Mr. David Lawrence wrote an open letter to a Russian journalist, which has been published in America, in several big American papers, and broadcast by The Voice of America. Ilya Ehrenberg has answered David Lawrence, and this is what he writes. You say that you hope that following my visit to America, I would describe the merits and the shortcomings of the United States. I have done this to the best of my ability. I have received many comments from both Soviet and American readers. Some of them have taken issue with me on one or another score, but all have granted that I have dwelt not only on the bad, but also the good points of America. What I like about your country is its talented and energetic people. Many of its scientists, writers, architects, film producers. I like the Tennessee Valley Project. Mass production of consumers' goods. Your advanced technique. Fine roads and automobiles. Your service. And a host of other splendid things. What I did not like about your country was the reaction, the scheming of the trusts behind the scenes, the hypocrisy of the imperialists, the corruption and flippancy of your own many colleagues, racial prejudice, the standardized production of cheap books and vulgar films. I didn't like its spiritual shallowness and lots of other unpleasant things. You say that I do not understand America, and that is why I do not approve of the content of the Russian language broadcast, The Voice of America. It seems to me that you are attacking me for the very reason that I do understand America a little. For instance, I know that publicity in your country is often hypocritical. A company buying up valuables will put out a radio blurb, help the war victims, and follow that with the address of its shops. I saw huge posters that urged the American consumer to economize on food because there are 500 million people starving on the face of the earth. And the posters were signed by the Heinz Company, manufacturers of delicatessens. That is why neither the Voice of America nor your letter came as a surprise to me. You say, we may admit that we do not correctly understand what you are doing in the Balkans, Greece, Turkey, and Korea. Yes. That was exactly what you said, in Greece, in Turkey. The answer to your question is very easy. We are not doing anything in Greece or Turkey. It's you who are doing it all. I don't even have to ask you about it. The whole world knows only too well what you are doing there. You continue, perhaps you do not understand the generosity of America's desire to help the Greek and Turkish peoples. As I see it, that would be hard not to understand. You yourselves have been so kind as to inform us through the Voice of America that a big lump of the sum America wants to grant the Greek monarchists is to go for quelling the rebels. Perhaps you can also tell us, since when have salaries for hangmen, rewards for jailers, and tips for gendarmes been considered proof of magnanimous impulses? Do you expect us to be touched by your help to Turkey? But we know that not long ago you refused to give food to Yugoslavia, which fought against our common foes, Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy. At the same time, you rushed to the aid of Turkey, which supplied Germany with all she could during the war. You think more of von Papen's friends than of the heroes of Montenegro, and you call that generosity. In all other languages, it is called cupidity. You do not give, you buy, and you bribe. You are not thinking about bread for starving Greeks, but rather about oil for well-fed Americans. I understand America a little. I know that in your country, one must not do anything ugly without clothing it in at least 100 fine phrases. Your letter says, you mentioned the Greek question, the Negro question. Be patient with us. We are making progress in this matter, and are doing so through education and the newspapers, and not by compulsion. But I have visited the southern states, and I have some idea of your progress in that field. The racial segregation law is still in force, and last year probably broke the record for the number of Negro pogroms and lynchings. In your country, Mr. David Lawrence, bloodthirsty Negro baiters and grasping slave owners have an absolutely free hand. You do not use any compulsion on them. An innocent Negro was executed in Jackson, Mississippi during my visit there. Everybody knew that he was innocent, but as it was explained to me, a Negro cannot possibly be vindicated if his accuser is a white. You cannot compel Mississippi jurors to respect principles of justice, for of course you are opposed to all compulsion. And whom are you improving with your education? The Negroes? In the South, the schools and universities are closed to them, while in the North, they are open to only a limited percent. Or perhaps it is the slave owners you are educating. In the school books published in the South that I saw, children are taught that there is a higher and a lower race. And is it lynching you are fighting against in your newspapers? Feed that nonsense to your own half-grown of mind. After the Negro pogrom in Columbia, Alabama, you didn't take the white assassins to trial, but instead the Negroes who managed to escape the lynchers. Your newspaper campaign on the pogrom boiled down to descriptions by court reporters of how the murdered victims had allegedly murdered the living murderers. You say, believe me, the American people sincerely admire the Russian people. You write that the clouds can be dispelled by the power of human love. Your letter overflows with love for my country and my people. That is how you talk to Soviet radio listeners and how you write to a Soviet author. Allow me to remind you of the things you say about my country and my people when you are talking straight to your own countrymen and not for export. I have before me your article of June 3rd, 1946, published in your magazine, The United States News. I happened to be in America at the time and was able to evaluate your endeavors on the spot, as it were. Your article entitled The Road to the Third World War said, steps are being taken at the present time which may lead to a Third World War. Russia has replaced Germany in the effort to dictate the future to the world. What is taking place in Russia is a menace to the rest of mankind. Russian aggression has begun. Are the American people going to ignore it? So it seems that you know how to write not only loving epistles, you also know how to bait. You want to start the road to the Third World War. I must say, I do not envy you, Mr. Loring. America's mothers should hate you. It is not for you to speak of the power of human love. I have also read your article published on August 26, 1946, after my departure from America. In my descriptions of America, I have tried rather to tone down the negative aspects of American life, holding as I still do that it was my duty to promote understanding between our two great nations. Ignoring a few spots on the sun, a few blemishes here and there, I have made no mention of you. You have asked for this yourself. It behooves me now to tell my Soviet readers that on August 26, 1946, you exhorted the American people to direct aggression. Better now, you said, while we have the equipment and great human reserves. Better for it to happen before our guns begin to rust. It would be fatal to wait 5 years for that test. Such is the nature of your love for us, Mr. Lawrence. You wrote, we heard Russia's voice calling for the second front, and we answered. Reading those lines, I had to smile. You were far quicker to answer my article, A False Voice. I can remember when our army began to talk about the second front. That was in the summer of 1942. I can also remember when the second front opened. That was in the summer of 1944. Now let me quote what you said on August 20th, 1946, not to me, but to your American readers. The United States must make it clear that by opening the second front in 1944, it saved Russia from disaster. You're quick to falsify history, Mr. Lawrence. The grass is still young on the graves of Stalingrad's defenders. Nobody saved us. We saved ourselves.